Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 1 through 42, a long session this time. I'm going to try to speak a little bit faster, summarize a little bit more to try to get through it. The name of this chapter will be Jonathan Warns David. Warns David about what? Namely, about Saul trying to kill David, which is our context. We're right in the middle of Saul's anger toward David. Remember, Saul has already tried to pin David against the wall with a spear three times. We start in 1 Samuel 20, verses 1 and 2. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?" He said to him, Jonathan said to David, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Now, David has fled from Naoth. In the previous chapter, we see David having fled from Saul trying to kill him by ambushing him in his house. Michael, David's wife, Saul's daughter, warned David, and David fled out the back door, back window, and fled right north of Gibeah to Ramah, met Samuel, and Samuel and him retreated even further north to Naoth, which was around the general area of Ramah. And there was a school of prophets. There was a group of prophets, a company of prophets. They were prophesying. Saul sent messengers three times, and they ended up prophesying instead of catching David like they were sent to do. Then Saul himself went. He fell down, it says, naked, or at least without his weapons, all day long, de-weaponized, if you will, before all the other prophets prophesying. And we can speculate he was prophesying, "David's going to be king. You're going to lose your kingdom." We don't know. But anyway, that's all what had just happened. And so David has left now Naoth and come back to Gibeah to see Jonathan. And he's saying, "Hey, Jonathan, why is your dad trying to kill me?" Now, this might not seem such a wise move on David's part to go back to the center of Saul's power. However, David wanted his friend Jonathan's counsel and protection. Jonathan's a big guy. He's the son of the king. He's David's only friend. What's David going to do? He has no power. He's popular in the government, but if the king wants to kill you, you're sort of in a bad situation. Now, in verse 1, when David asked Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity?" Here's a couple of options of how you can interpret that. Perhaps option number one, David is genuinely unaware of Saul's jealousy. He's asking a question. What have I done? He can't understand how Saul could treat him that way. After all the kindness and loyalty David had shown Saul, playing the harp before him when Saul was crazy, fighting the Philistines. So what have I done? I've never tried to commit treason. Or you could read it this way. What have I done? In other words, David is ventilating his anger toward Saul, and he wants Jonathan, Saul's son, to know that David is not happy about Saul's actions. I suspect it's the latter. Although it could be the former. Maybe David doesn't really know what's going on. Maybe he thinks, well, maybe it's because Saul's crazy. Why is he so mad at me? And he's genuinely perplexed. It's hard to say. And anyway, in verse 2, Jonathan responds to David and says, hey, you're not going to die. My father, it doesn't do anything without letting me know. He would have told me by now if he was planning on killing you. Now, Jonathan has a hard time here believing that Saul would want to kill David, and David, of course, is trying to convince him. Well, let's look at some reasons why Jonathan would not think that Saul was trying to kill David. First of all, Saul would surely have told Jonathan, as we read in verse 2, "Hey, my father does nothing great or small without disclosing it to me. He would have told me." So that's what Jonathan's thinking. After all, Saul had confided his murderous intention to Jonathan in the past. In verse 1 of chapter 19, Saul ordered his son Jonathan and all his servants to kill David. So Jonathan had already been told once by Saul that Jonathan should go out and kill David. So Saul told him once, why not tell him again? So that's why Saul is thinking, Jonathan is thinking, I don't think Saul's after David right now. That's one reason. Here's another reason. Jonathan may have dismissed Saul's actions against David as being under the influence of Saul's madness. Oh, he's just crazy, David. You know, when people are drunk, that's just when he's in his alcohol, he's angry. But when he's not drinking, he's perfectly happy. Of course, he's drinking all the time. And you know how that goes. So maybe Jonathan just dismissed Saul's actions because of that craziness that Saul had. Or it could be Jonathan thought that Saul wouldn't hurt David because Saul had taken an oath with Jonathan not to hurt David. We see this in 1 Samuel 19:6. Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed. That's an oath. Saul vowed, "As the Lord lives," that's a vow in the name of Yahweh, "as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." Well, that's a serious oath, an oath in the name of Yahweh. And so Jonathan might be thinking that Saul still had enough honor left in him where he would abide by his oath. Another reason Jonathan might have thought that Saul was innocent of any intentions to kill David is because the Holy Spirit had fallen on Saul at Naioth just recently at Samuel's company of prophets up there when Saul fell down and prophesied all night long, naked, on the way to Naioth, it says, and after he got there. And so Jonathan's mind thinking, well, the Holy Spirit must be working on Saul now. He's turned into a prophet. So I don't think he's going to be trying to kill David. Well, those are reasons why Jonathan had a hard time believing Saul was a murderer, that he had murderous intention in his heart. But here's some reasons why Jonathan should have known that Saul was trying to kill David. It's hard to believe that Jonathan wouldn't have known of those messengers that were sent up three times, those sets of messengers that were sent to Naioth to kill David. Jonathan's in the court. He's a big shot. He would have known. He would have known that Saul had left Gibeah to go up at Naioth to kill David. So maybe Jonathan is conflicted in his mind. He's just not really sure. But at any rate, he tries to convince David of something that if David had believed him, it would have cost David his life. So we're going to see now in this chapter, this back and forth. Is Saul really not like David? Is he really want to kill David, or is he going to take David back in his good graces? Now, here's another option about Jonathan's attitude. Maybe Jonathan really did suspect Saul's true motives, that Saul was trying to kill David. But maybe he was trying to sugarcoat his father's intentions. And why would he do that? Well, perhaps to allay David's fears. It's not as bad as all that, David. You need to calm down. Or maybe he was in denial. It's hard to admit that your father, the king, is a murderer, and he just couldn't face the fact. Or maybe it's because he was trying to defend his father because he was his father's son and he had a filial attachment to his father. So you see, there's a lot of different possibilities about what Jonathan's thinking here. But we know objectively that, yes, Saul was trying to kill David, even though David or Jonathan might not know it yet. We go to 1 Samuel 20, verses 3 and 4. Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved." What David is trying to do here is say, look, you say that your father would tell you. No, your father's not going to tell you, because if he told you that he was trying to kill me, that would make you very sad, and he doesn't want to make you sad, Jonathan. So David is contradicting Jonathan on point number one, that Saul would let Jonathan know, and since Saul hadn't let Jonathan know, therefore Saul's not coming after David. David says, nope, that's not true. He's already said he's not going to let you know because that would make you grieved. David continues, verse 3, "But truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." Ooh, that's a poetic way of saying it. I got one more step and I'm toast. Verse 4, "Then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you." So it looks like David has convinced Jonathan that, yes, Saul's really after him. Now notice that David resorted to a solemn oath in order to convince Jonathan. Verse 3, "Yet David vowed again." That's a solemn oath. Now, David was very gentle with his words for Jonathan. He was trying to put Saul in the best light possible. He was trying to say, look, Saul is not conspiring to shut Jonathan out of Saul's counsels. He's saying the reason he didn't tell you, Jonathan, he didn't want to make you sad, but he's not really trying to shut you out and keep you from being a big shot in the kingdom. David didn't want to wound Jonathan's filial affection for Saul. I think you can read between the lines and think that's true and see that that's true. Now, why did David say that Saul didn't talk to Jonathan about his intentions? Because it would grieve Jonathan. How would that grieve Jonathan? Well, Jonathan would find out that his father was a murderer and that David was in danger of his life. Yeah, that would grieve Jonathan pretty much. And so David's saying, look, he's not telling you the bad news. He's a murderer. He's coming after me. He's coming after your good friend that you're in covenant with. Finally, in verse 4, Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." Well, apparently at this point, Jonathan believed David when Jonathan said David was in trouble, when David said that he himself was in trouble. And so when Jonathan said, "Whatever you say, I will do," what might that entail? Perhaps Jonathan could speak to Saul on David's behalf. Maybe he could hide David somewhere. We'll see that he did both, actually, as time went on. We go now to 1 Samuel 20, verses 5 through 7. So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family.' If he says, it is good, your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. So now we're going to have a little test so David can prove to Jonathan that, yes, your dad is a murderer. I suspect David already knew that, but maybe he wants to see too. But at least he's going to show Jonathan, maybe even show himself, that Saul's a murderer or not. So tomorrow's the new moon. That's the Feast of the New Moon, mentioned in Numbers 10:10 and Numbers 28:11, which I won't read for you. That's a monthly feast the Israelites had. The Encyclopedia Britannica states that the new moon is Hebrew Rosh Chodesh, in Hebrew, which translated means head of the month, the start of the Hebrew month, a minor Jewish festival on which fasting and mourning are not allowed. Now, David asked Jonathan's right to leave and miss this Jewish festival, at which Saul would be present and at which David should be present. David says to Jonathan, let me go. Well, Jonathan had the right to grant David leave since Saul had gone away to Naoth chasing David down. And so that was a legitimate request. Remember, David's a military guy. Jonathan's a military guy, as well as friends. So he asked permission that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. Now, doubtless he meant some cave in the field. You can't hide yourself in open in the open pastures there where everybody can see you. But it's a cave in the field until the third evening. That would be, there's the Feast of the New Moon on the first day, New Moon. And then they had another meal the next night just in case they calculated the first day wrongly. So they had a feast on the second day. And then if you got to the third day and Saul hadn't said anything, David said, okay, I'm fine. Now, here's how it works. Saul might not notice David's absence on the day of the new moon. That's the first day. And then the next day, Saul might not notice David's absence on the second day. Now, from the third day, Saul did not miss David. Then David, I assume, would leave his hiding place and come back to court, having deduced that Saul had no further intent to harm him. We'll see that Saul's suspicion was not allayed for the whole 3 days. He finally got suspicious. Now, verse 6. The scripture says, if your father misses me at all, then say, David is asking Jonathan to say this, a lie, by the way. David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, or at least it apparently is a lie, because it is of the yearly sacrifice. What's this yearly sacrifice that is going to be happening in Jesse's family down in Bethlehem? Well, there are three options. One, it could be one of the three annual feasts, Passover, Feast of Weeks, Feast of Booths. Problem with that is none of those three were celebrated at the first of the month, which it was now. And another problem is those three feasts were supposed to be kept at the tabernacle, not at Bethlehem. That's because of the law in Deuteronomy 12:5. Instead, you must turn to the place Yahweh your God chooses from all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling and go there. And of course, that would be at the tabernacle, but the tabernacle had been destroyed at Shiloh. We assume the Philistines did it, although it doesn't actually say that. Ellicott says, ever since the destruction of the tabernacle of Shiloh, there had been no central sanctuary, wherever that destruction occurred, and these solemn feasts had been held most probably in tribal centers. In the then disorganized condition of public worship to which David first gave regular form, family usages of this sort, after the manner of other nations, had established themselves, which are contrary to the Mosaic prescriptions concerning the unity of divine worship. Ellicott, quoting another scholar, Uvon Gerlach, points that out, and I think that makes a lot of sense, that the local families were doing the priestly duties that God meant to be done at the tabernacle, which eventually would be at the temple in Jerusalem. But anyway, so that might not be a problem as the fact of where it was being held in Bethlehem, but the fact that it wasn't on the first of the month, I think, precludes that option that it's one of the three annual feasts that David was pretending to go down to. So option number two, this was a Thanksgiving feast that Jesse's family by themselves did annually. It's a private family gathering once a year to give thanks to God. Or maybe it was a new moon feast that Jesse did for his family annually. And it could be a new moon feast that he did for his family monthly, for that matter. It was a special type of new moon feast because all the tribes of Jesse's family ate it once a year, not everybody. Or it could be a combination of B and C, a special Thanksgiving feast combined with a new moon feast. We don't know, but at any rate, nobody seemed to be taken back about this story about a yearly sacrifice in Bethlehem. It didn't seem to be strange to anybody. So if Saul responded to David with this lie, at being confronted with this lie, if Saul says, it is good, David will be safe. If he's angry, then Saul has decided on evil. And we're going to find out Saul gets angry. So that's how we're going to know that Saul is really, like we don't know already, but I mean, David's had three spears thrown at him. Of course, you could say, well, he was crazy when he did that. He didn't really mean it. Well, this would not be when he was crazy. This would be a conscience decision on Saul's part to get angry for David missing that feast. Now, next question. Was this a justifiable lie on Jonathan's part? Well, here are three options to answer that. First of all, we can say, well, it wasn't a lie. David really did need to go to the yearly sacrifice for his family. I don't think so. He's going to be hiding in a field. We're going to see in a little bit he's going to get out of that field. He didn't have time to go down to Bethlehem. I don't think that's going to fly. But let's say it was a lie. Well, you could say it was a lie, but it was not a sin. After all, he's trying to, you know, this is warfare. This is not your normal circumstance. You know, I have this apologist friend who loves presuppositional apologetics, and he's constantly saying, God is not a God that he would lie. Well, that's because God lives in heaven where there aren't enemies trying to kill him. Nobody's going to kill God. He doesn't need to lie. But down here on earth, in the presence of spies, in the presence of hostile armies, sometimes you have to lie, like the Hebrew midwives lied. They were never condemned. They're put in the Hebrews 11 Hall of Fame, Faith Hall of Fame, even though they lied. Rachel lied to save the Israelites. This is war, folks, warfare. So if he lied, and I'm in full accord with this, I don't blame him one bit. Now, some people say it's not clear whether it was a lie or not. Here's what the Cambridge commentary says. It is not clear whether David really wanted to go to Bethlehem and meant to hide in the field afterwards. I just said he didn't have time to go down there, but some people think he did. He went down to Bethlehem and then he was going to come back and hide in the field. Cambridge continues, or whether he regarded the story as a justifiable deception to avoid exciting Saul's anger. Well, I'm going to take a stand on the hill there and say, yeah, I think it was a justifiable lie. I don't think he went down to Bethlehem. Other people might disagree. Now, all of this, of course, is a test. Verse 7 says, if he says it's good, if he says it's angry, then we'll know. What's the point of testing Saul's attitude? Well, a couple of options. One, David might want to show Jonathan what Saul was really thinking. And David already knew it, but he wanted to convince Jonathan of it. A problem with that view is that Jonathan seems to have already understood what Saul's attitude was. Remember in verse 4, David's trying to convince Jonathan, hey, he wouldn't have told you if he's trying to kill me. I'm one step away from death and all that. In 1 Samuel 24, Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. It sounds like he's already convinced. Yeah, well, maybe so. But this test would confirm it in Jonathan's mind. After all, it's a big deal. It's treason to go against your own father when you're the heir apparent, the crown prince. That's a big deal. And David needs to convince Jonathan, yes, it's true. It's not because of his craziness that he's after me. He wants to kill me. He's jealous. It could be that David himself is not really sure about Saul's attitude and that he wanted to see if Saul had changed his mind since trying to spear him, since Saul had gone to Naoth and become a prophet under the influence of the Holy Spirit. At any rate, somebody is doubting completely whether Saul is sincere in his efforts to kill David, and the truth needed to come out, and hence the test. We go to 1 Samuel 20, verses 8 and 9. Therefore, David continues to speak to Jonathan, deal kindly with your servant David, me. For you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself. For why then should you bring me to your father? Jonathan said, far be it from you. For if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it? Well, now, there might be a little distrust on the part of David. Maybe Jonathan knows, but he's not telling me, even though he's my good friend. Ooh, Jonathan doesn't want David to say that. So in verse 9, he says, if I learn, I'm going to tell you. Don't you doubt me, David. David, of course, says in verse 8, deal kindly with me, Jonathan. Tell me about Saul's state of mind. Apparently, he might have a little bit of doubt that Jonathan's going to tell him the truth. And David, in order to get him to tell him the truth, brings to Jonathan's recall the covenant that Jonathan and David had made. That was in 1 Samuel 18:3. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as much as himself. And notice it was Jonathan who was the first mover in that covenant. Jonathan made a covenant with David. Now, that's a speculation. It could be just an accident of which order the proper names are in. But it does sound like Jonathan was the one who initiated the covenant. But whether he did or not, they're in a covenant, and David said he appeals to that covenant. Tell me the truth now. Don't hide it from me. And David, to further his point, says, it was a covenant of the Lord that I made with you, of Yahweh, in the name and fear of the Lord. David then says, but if there's iniquity in me, Jonathan, put me to death yourself. Now, of course, David knew that he was innocent. He also knew that Jonathan was not going to kill him for treason. That wasn't his point. he's just trying to be hyperbolic here and say, look, you might as well kill me now if you think I'm a traitor. For why then should you bring me to your father? In other words, there's no need for you. If you kill me yourself, you don't need to bring me to your father and say, here's a traitor, David. Just kill me now. He's kind of opening himself up to Jonathan, saying, here's my breast, stab a knife in it if you really think I'm guilty. And of course, I don't think David really thought that. He was just being extreme here, just making a point. And of course, he's being hyperbolic here in order to convince Jonathan. Jonathan, he's still, David is not sure, and maybe Dan, Jonathan is not sure. Is Saul really trying to kill David? That's point number one they're not sure about. Point number two is David a traitor or not? Jonathan might have some doubt. Point number three, David might have some doubt about Jonathan. Is Jonathan going to let me go, or is he going to go with his father and get me killed? Lots of doubt here. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 10 through 15. So David asked Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? He answers, David, come on, let's go out to the field. So both of them went out to the field. By the Lord, the God of Israel, I will sound out my father by this time tomorrow or the next day. If I find out that he is favorable towards you, will I not send for you and tell you? If my father intends to bring evil on you, may God punish Jonathan and do so severely if I do not tell you and send you away so you may go in peace. May the Lord be with you just as he was with my father. If I continue to live, treat me with the Lord's faithful love. But if I die, don't ever withdraw your faithful love from my household, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Now in verse 10, David asked Jonathan, who's going to tell me if your father answers you harshly? There's a problem here. After the test of the banquet, if Saul gets angry, would it be safe for Jonathan to come tell David? No, it won't be. But Jonathan says, that's okay. I'll take the risk if Saul's angry. I will. I'll tell you. He says in verse 13, may God punish Jonathan and do so severely if I do not tell you. I'll let you know. And that would have to be personally, because Jonathan could not entrust a messenger with news of Saul's anger. It would put the messenger's life at risk. If Saul found out, he could kill the messenger. The messenger might turn Jonathan into Saul. Hey, your son's telling me to send treasonous notes to David. And then Saul might say, okay, Jonathan, it's time for you to shuffle off your mortal coil. Or the messenger might betray David by lying to him and saying, there's no problem. Saul's not mad with you. And then David goes back to the court and Saul arrests him, kills him. So a messenger can't do it. It's got to be a person. And that's Jonathan. And he tells David, I'm going to do it. I'll tell you. Now in verse 11, all this discussion is taking place in a field. Let's go out to the field. It doesn't say what field it is. It's some field outside of Gibeah. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown gives a good preview of what's happening here in pretty flowery language. Let me read that for you. Quote, the private dialogue, which is here detailed at full length, presents a most beautiful exhibition of these two amiable and noble-minded friends. Jonathan was led in the circumstances to be the chief speaker. The strength of his attachment, his pure disinterestedness, his warm piety, his invocation to God, consisting of a prayer and a solemn oath combined, the calm and full expression he gave of his conviction that his own family were, by the divine will, to be disinherited, and David elevated to the possession of his throne, to the possession of the throne, the covenant entered into with David on behalf of his descendants, and the imprecation. That comes next verse. Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord hold David's enemies accountable. Denounced on any of them who should violate his part of the conditions, the reiteration of this covenant on both sides, that's coming again in verse 17. Jonathan once again swore to David and his love for him. So another oath. So that was another oath to make the original covenant between the two indissoluble. All this indicates such a power of mutual affection, such magnetic attractiveness in the character of David, such susceptibility and elevation of feeling in the heart of Jonathan, that this interview for dramatic interest and moral beauty stands unrivaled in the records of human friendship. That's some florid 19th century rhetoric, folks. I love it. The oath that was mentioned here, the prayer and the oath, that's verse 12. By the Lord, that's by Yahweh, the God of Israel. So that's a serious oath that Jonathan has taken. He says in verse 12, will I not send for you and tell you if Saul is favorable? Now, he could send a messenger if Saul's not angry, because there would be no danger then. But if Saul was angry, he'd have to go himself. Now, in verse 13, Jonathan says, may God punish me severely if I do not tell you. And then he says, may the Lord be with you just as he was with my father. Notice the past tense. Yeah, God, the Holy Spirit was on Saul. He was chosen by God and he completely blew it. As he was with my father. Yes, sir. Saul is Ichabod. The Holy Spirit is left. Now, Jonathan finishes up, says, look, if I live, treat me faithfully, because I assume that what he means is if he manages to survive Saul, which actually he didn't, he got killed fighting at Gilboa against the Philistines under Saul's command. But he's saying, please treat me faithfully. And then he says, but on the other hand, if I die, don't withdraw your faithful love from my household, nor is his descendants. Now, we're going to look at that when David takes over at Hebron after he's been in the wilderness for a while running from Saul. We'll look at this covenant with David to not withdraw David's faithful love from Jonathan's descendants, his household. Not even when the Lord cuts off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. In other words, when you're sitting pretty, David, and you've got all kinds of power, don't use that power against my descendants, please. We go now to 1 Samuel 20, verses 16 and 17. Then Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord hold David's enemies accountable. Jonathan once again swore to David in his love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. Now, when Jonathan makes a covenant in verse 16, this is the old covenant in 1 Samuel 18:3, which I've already mentioned. That covenant was renewed, but this time it was extended to the house of David. Not only a covenant between David personally and Jonathan, but also to the descendants of David. And of course, the covenant, the obligations would extend to Jonathan's descendants also. Jonathan swore this covenant in verse 17 because of his love for David. His love for David was a more important motivation than his own safety and for the safety of his offspring. We go now to 1 Samuel 20, verses 18 through 23. Then Jonathan said to him, tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. When you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day. And you shall remain by the stone Ezel. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And behold, I will send the lad saying, go find the arrows. If I specifically say to the lad, behold, the arrows are on this side of you, get them. Then come, Jonathan tells David. Then if you hear that, come on, for there is safety for you and no harm. Come back to Gibeah, back to the court. As the Lord lives. Again, that's that vow they take all the time. It really is true. Verse 22, but if I say to the youth, behold, the arrows are beyond you, go. Leave Gibeah. For the Lord has sent you away, as for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, that's the covenant. Behold, the Lord is between you and me forever, as long as they live and as long as their descendants live. Now, Jonathan tells David in verse 19, when you have stayed for 3 days, stayed where? Well, it could be in Bethlehem going down to that feast, which I don't believe, but could be. Or it could be once you have stayed in some unnamed hiding place. Or it could be when you have stayed in the field for 3 days. I've always taken it that way. The field that David had agreed with Jonathan to hide in, 1 Samuel 20, verse 5. So David told him, look, tomorrow is the new moon, and I'm supposed to sit down and eat with the king. Instead, let me go, and I'll hide in the field until the third night. And I think that's what it is. John Gill disagrees. He says, no, David couldn't be hiding in a field, in that cave in the field, for 3 days. He couldn't stay there for 3 days. To which I respond, why not? David's a battle-hardened soldier. He can't take some food and live in a cave for 3 days, please. I could do that. Now, David is supposed to hide by the rock Ezel, the stone Ezel, E-Z-E-L, Ezel. Probably not Ezel, but Ezel. The name Ezel means going. Where did it get its name? Option number one, it could be a stone to mark road directions for travelers. But against that option is the fact that it would be unlikely for David to go hide in a public place like that in front of a road marker. More probably, Ezel got its name afterwards because David and Jonathan were going to meet there. They were, quote-unquote, going, proceeding to meet there. And, of course, it was probably a cave near that rock where David was hiding. Now, this stratagem of using arrows, if my messenger boy says, oh, if I shout at my messenger, if I shout at my attendant, he's not really meant to be a messenger, he's an attendant. If I shout, oh, the arrows are to your side, well then, no problem. But if I say, hey, keep going, the arrows have passed you, you need to keep going too, David, because you're not safe anymore because Saul is indeed angry. And this is how Jonathan figures out how to talk to David without putting himself and David in fear of their lives. And for all of you who are worried about Jonathan telling a lie to Saul, well, he's still doing it because this is not a verbal lie, but it's a stratagem and it's meant to deceive. Are we going to say this is somehow something immoral about this? I don't think so. The stratagem was necessary because if a messenger sent, 3 lives would be endangered. The messenger's life, Jonathan's life, and David's life. Saul would have killed them all. Now, the target that Jonathan is pretending to shoot at for target practice is probably the stony Zell. This would arouse no suspicion. It would look like Jonathan's just out there practicing shooting his arrows like they did all the time back then. Now, the way the stratagem probably worked is this. Depending on Saul's attitude, Jonathan would choose when to call out to the boy. If Saul was angry and David ought to flee, then Jonathan would call out early. As the boy got to where the arrows were, he would say, before the boy got to where the arrows were, Jonathan would call out, "Hey, the arrows are beyond you, keep going," and then David would leave to his banishment. But if David ought to return because Saul wasn't angry, Jonathan would call out late, after the boy had passed the arrows, then he would call out, "There they are, there to your side," so David would know to return. Of course, we know that Saul's angry, and so the former happened. Jonathan says, "They're beyond you," and David has got to get out of Dodge. And once again, Jonathan assures David, verse 23, "As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken," this is the renewal of the covenant, their personal covenant, "behold, the Lord is between you and me forever." He keeps saying, they keep going back to that covenant. And remember, back then, these people were big on covenants, and much more so than us. Covenant is much more than a contract. It's a formal, solemn contract that means a lot more than, "Are you going to sell me a computer for money?" We go to 1 Samuel 20, verses 24 through 26. "So David hid in the field. At the new moon, the king sat down to eat the meal. He sat at his usual place on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat facing him, and Abner took his place beside Saul. But David's place was empty. Saul did not say anything that day because he thought, 'Something unexpected has happened. David must be ceremonially unclean.'" Yes, that's it. He is unclean. So he hid in the field either for 3 days or after 3 days, depending on your view of whether he went to Bethlehem first for that annual feast. Meanwhile, in the king's house, the palace, at the new moon, the king sat down to eat the meal. Now, this is what Jamison Fawcett Brown says about honorific places at the table. Quote, "The left-hand corner at the upper end of a room was, and still is, in the east, the most honorable place. The person seated there has his left arm confined by the wall, but his right hand is at full liberty. From Abner's position next to the king and David's seat being left empty, it would seem that a state etiquette was observed at the royal table, each of the courtiers and ministers having places assigned them according to their respective gradations of rank." And I don't doubt that in the least. I guess my view is colored by 23 years in China. I ate so many banquets at tables. You walk into the restaurant room, there's a round table. Pretend that table is a clock. I always sat at 12 o'clock. Always. And I never even thought about it until somebody told me that's the place of honor. And my wife always sat to my left. It never occurred to me. They were trying to show me honor because I was so culturally obtuse, I didn't realize it. So I believe that this is what's happening here. Now, in verse 25, it says that Jonathan sat facing him, facing Saul. Now, this is an interesting translation problem. The NASB says that Jonathan rose up. Now, the ASV says Jonathan stood up. Bible and Basic English says that Jonathan sat down in front. God's Word translation says Jonathan stood up. King James says he arose. The New American Bible says that Jonathan sat facing him, facing Saul. The Young's Literal translation said that Jonathan riseth. He stood up, in other words. So there's two options here. It gets a translation problem. If it's true that Jonathan rose up and stood up, why? Well, it could be because of his reverence for Saul, either because Saul was the king of Israel or because that Saul was his father. It could have been he was standing up out of reverence for Abner, too, who was the chief of the military. It was probably because of Saul. At any rate, Jonathan is sitting there, and there David's place was empty. It's David's place, so I think that's probably a particular place depending on your rank in the kingdom. He's not there. Verse 26, Saul didn't say anything that day, but that's the first day of the new moon, because he thought something unexpected has happened. He must ceremonially be unclean. Perhaps he had a nocturnal emission making himself unclean. Maybe David touched a dead animal. There's a lot of ways you can get to be unclean, and so Saul's not too suspicious. We go down to 1 Samuel 20, verses 27 through 29. "It came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, 'Why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal, either yesterday or today?' Jonathan then answered Saul, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. For he said, please let me go, since our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away that I may see my brothers.' For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. Well, the first question is, why is there a second day of the new moon? A second day in which the king's, on which the king's officials were eating another meal. Well, the reason for that is if there was difficulty in determining which day was the new moon day, 2 days were kept in order to make sure. Now, there were offerings of such of several sorts at these new moon festivals. If there were votive or free will peace offerings, they could be eaten the next day. Thanksgiving peace offerings could not be eaten. They had to be eaten the same night. But there was leftovers for a vow or a free will offering, and so they could just keep right on going. Second day. Now, by the way, this is custom, not law, that it established this practice of two new moon festival days. Saul turns to Jonathan and says, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal? Gil says that the term son of Jesse is a term of contempt. This son of Jesse. He's going to call Jonathan later, you son of a perverse woman. Now he's calling him the son of Jesse. He didn't use his name. Gil could be right that was a term of contempt. So it's reasonable speculation. Why did Saul turn to Jonathan to ask this question? Well, Saul knew that Jonathan was in tight with David. He's not stupid. And then Jonathan gives Saul, which is apparently a cock and bull story. Well, let me back up a minute here. Calling David son of Jesse, this is a way of addressing David without acknowledging that David was Saul's son-in-law. So he calls him son of Jesse. He doesn't say my son-in-law. Where's my son-in-law? Now, why has he not come to the meal, Saul asked. Well, the first day he thought, well, maybe he's ritually unclean, but he's not going to be ritually unclean for 2 days. Usually those minor ritual infractions, it took a day to get clean again. And so Saul's suspicious now, second day. He's paranoid anyway, and so the second day he's starting to wonder. And then Jonathan comes up with this story about David being asked to go back to Bethlehem to participate in an annual family feast. And as I said, we debate whether that was a true story or whether that was a lie. I don't care whether it's true or a lie, but he was perfectly justified in saying it, in my humble opinion. Now, in the story that Jonathan tells his father Saul, he's relating what David said, and he said, David has said, my brother has commanded me to attend. That would be probably his older brother, Eliab, the same brother that griped when David shows up on the field at Socoh against Goliath. What are you doing here? You're supposed to be back tending the sheep. Well, apparently Eliab, the older brother, has got power in the family. This is patriarchal society. The older brother's the big shot. And so he was telling David, you got to come sacrifice. So Jonathan's telling the story real good here. We go now to 1 Samuel 20, chapter 20, verse 30. Then Saul became angry with Jonathan and shouted, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you're siding with Jesse's son to your own shame and to the disgrace of your mother? Saul's angry. Why? Because he knows that Jonathan's story didn't hold up. Saul's not stupid. He figured out that Jonathan wasn't exactly being straight with him. Well, it's true, Jonathan's story didn't hold up, but his story did manage to find out how the king was truly thinking, so the test devised by David and Jonathan worked. Now we know Saul is coming after David. And Saul shouts to his own son, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. Well, who was Jonathan the son of, this perverse and rebellious woman? Well, that would be Ahinoam. Ahinoam was Saul's wife and Jonathan's mother. We know that from 1 Samuel 14, verses 49 and 50. Saul's sons were Jonathan and two others. The names of his daughters were da 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 da. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, and his son was Jonathan, as well as two others, Ishvi and Malchishua. So the question is, was Saul trying to curse his wife Ahinoam? Well, no. We don't curse a dog when we say that so-and-so is a son of a bitch. The bitch is the dog, but we're not cursing the bitch. We're not cursing the female dog, the mother. We're cursing the son of said bitch. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, this is a striking oriental form of abuse. Saul was not angry with his wife. It was the son alone upon whom he meant by this style of address to discharge his resentment. The principle on which it is founded seems to be that to a genuine filial instinct, it is a more inexpiable offense to bear the name or character of a parent traduced than any personal reproach. This was undoubtedly one cause of the fierce anger in which the high-minded prince left the table without tasting a morsel. It's just like today, you know, if you say yo mama, for some reason you bring your mother into something, that's considered a horrible curse, even in today's culture. So back then, too, Saul was using a terrible curse upon, or a terrible reproach upon his son when he says, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." And it's interesting that Gill says the original Hebrew doesn't even have the word woman in it, but all the translations I looked at have it. Because when you say son of perverse rebellion, you know, that could be what he was saying, but no, I'm sure he was saying, "You son of a perverse woman." Now, Saul says that his son Jonathan is siding with David to his own shame. Now, why would siding with David shame Jonathan? Well, because Jonathan has become good friends with the man David, who is going to push him out of his throne should he succeed. So that would be to the shame of Jonathan. Also, people would think that he's not fit to rule. How dare you stand up for a rebel against the duly instituted king of Israel? So that's why Saul is screaming at his son Jonathan. He also says that Jonathan has disgraced his mother, Ahinoam. Other translations have it, "Jonathan, you have acted to the shame of the mother who bore you." That's the NIV. The NASB says, "You have acted to the shame of your mother's nakedness." That's an interesting idiom. I think it means if your mother's naked, she's going to be ashamed. Well, why would Jonathan's mother be ashamed? Well, she would lose the honor she expected. She expected to be the mother of a king, and instead she's the mother of a rebel, a traitor. We go down to 1 Samuel 20, verse 31. "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you," this is Saul talking to Jonathan, "neither you, Jonathan, nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now, send and bring him to me, for he must surely die." Now, Saul is, this is rich. Is he one to be telling someone that the kingdom will not be established? Samuel has already told Saul twice Saul's kingdom would be taken away from him. At Gilgal, before the Battle of Michmash, 1 Samuel 13:14, Saul tells Samuel, "But now your reign will not endure. The Lord has found a man loyal to him," that would be David, "and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not done what the Lord commanded." Well, that's one place. Samuel told Saul that he was kaputsky as the king of Israel. Also at Gilgal, after Saul beat the Amalekites, 1 Samuel 15, two chapters later, 1 Samuel 15:23, Samuel tells Saul, "For rebellion," i.e. your rebellion, Saul, "is like the sin of divination, and defiance is like wickedness and idolatry, because you have rejected the word of the Lord. He has rejected you as king." And five verses later, in verse 28, chapter 15, Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingship of Israel away from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you," the neighbor being David. So really now, Saul is telling Jonathan that your kingdom will not be established. His kingdom is not established anyway, because Saul's kingdom itself was not established, had been torn away from him, and Jonathan was the heir of Saul. So Jonathan is finished as king anyway. He's a crown prince of a nothing kingdom, of a nothing king. But he's still breathing fire and trying to appeal to Jonathan's self-interest, get David, kill him so you could be king. 1 Samuel 20, verses 32 through 34, Jonathan answered his father back, "Why is he to be killed? What has he done?" And Saul threw his spear at Jonathan to kill him. So he knew that his father was determined. So he, Jonathan, knew that his father was determined to kill David. He, that's Jonathan, got up from the table in fierce anger and did not eat any food that second day of the new moon, for he was grieved because of his father's shameful behavior towards David. What has he done? Jonathan asked Saul. Well, here's what David had not done. He had not tried to kill Saul like Saul had tried to kill David. He had not tried to take away Saul's crown, even though he very well could have. And here's what David had done. He had helped Saul through his demonized mental illness. He had fought bravely over and over again against the Philistines. That's what he'd done. And so Jonathan had the better of that argument, and Saul responded in a diplomatic, rational, intelligent way by throwing a spear at his own son in order to kill him. Well, now Saul's true intentions are now out in the open. Apparently, it was the custom for kings of the time to carry spears around, as Gill said. Saul, in fact, had already tried to kill David three times with his spear, and now he's trying for his own son. Now, notice in verse 34, Jonathan was grieved because of his father's shameful behavior toward David. Not grieved because of his father's shameful behavior toward he himself, Jonathan, but toward David, which is kind of interesting. I mean, Saul had already called his own son a son of a perverse and rebellious woman, which is just basically like calling somebody of a son of a bitch. And this is your father calling your son that? That's pretty shameful. And not only that, Saul had picked up a spear and tried to kill Jonathan. Yet Jonathan's more upset because of his father's shameful behavior towards David. Now that's a friend. That's a true friend. This Jonathan is quite an admirable character, I think, as everybody agrees. We go now to 1 Samuel 20, verses 35 through 40. Now it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field for the appointment with David, and a little lad was with him. He said to his lad, "Run, Find now the arrows which I am about to shoot. As the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And Jonathan called after the lad, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." And Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master. But the lad was not aware of anything. Only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. This is because of the prearranged code they had set up. Verse 40, then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, "Go, bring them to the city." Now, in verse 36, Jonathan shot an arrow past the lad, that so that he could say the arrow was beyond the boy when he called out to him. Now, there's a question. Why was there a need for this sign to secretly convey to David that it's time to get out of Dodge? David and Jonathan ended up meeting in verse 41, as we'll see. As the lad leaves, he meets with him. Well, the reason for that is, at the time Jonathan shot the arrows, he didn't know if there would be people around. And if there happened to be people around, he wouldn't get to talk to David. So he set up this system of signaling, so just in case there were people around, he could get to talk to David. And we'll see later, in verse 40, he sent the lad away to take Jonathan's bow and arrow back to the city. That got rid of the little lad, and so now Jonathan knows, hey, I'm alone with David, I can talk to him. But he didn't know that when they set up this scheme, this signaling scheme. And so in verse 40, seeing that no one was passing by, Jonathan wanted to dismiss the boy quickly so he would have a chance to talk to David. So he says, "Take my weapons back to the city." Now there's a minor translation problem here. In verse 37, we see when the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And Jonathan called after the lad, and Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master. Well, now, the interesting thing is that when they set up the signaling scheme back in verse 20, Jonathan told David, "I will shoot three arrows to the side as though I shot at a target." Three arrows, but here is just one arrow. So what's the problem? Well, first of all, let's assume that the NASB and the NIV are right. They have arrow in the singular in verses 37. "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And verse 38, "Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow," singular. We've got two translations that have it singular. Well, let's assume that's right just for the sake of argument. Well, then arrow number two and arrow number three could be for backup in case something went wrong with arrow number one. For example, if Jonathan failed to get the arrow past where the boy was standing, although I think somebody as skilled as Jonathan wouldn't have any trouble with that. But that's one way to handle that. In other words, it was just a change in plans. Jonathan had told David at first, "I'm going to shoot arrows," but then he decided, "Well, I'm going to just shoot one arrow at a time just to make sure." That could be. But it's interesting, there are other translations that have arrow in the plural as arrows. For example, God's Word translation have, "Jonathan called after him," after the lad, "the arrows," plural, "are next to you." Jonathan added, verse 38, "Jonathan's young servant gathered the arrows," plural. Well, that would solve the discrepancy between the plan and the execution of the plan, both in the plural. Some translations have the first arrow in the singular and the second in the plural. For example, the Darby translation, verse 37, Jonathan tells the little boy, "Is not the arrow," singular, "away beyond thee?" And in verse 38, "Jonathan's lad picked up the arrows," plural. Young's Little translation has it exactly the same way. Verse 37, Jonathan calls to the youth, "Is not the arrow," singular, "beyond you?" And Jonathan called after the youth, "Hurry up and gather up the arrows," plural. So again, we're not going to get into that. You take a Hebrew expert to know whether it's singular or plural, and apparently the translations don't agree. But it's nothing to worry about. It's just a translation issue. Now, in verse 38, when Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay," after he said the arrow is beyond you, that "hurry, be quick, and do not stay" was ostensibly aimed at the little boy, but actually it was aimed at David, so David would hear this, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." In other words, get out of town. Jonathan is real mad at you, David. We go to verses 41 and 42 of 1 Samuel 20, and we will be finished with this long chapter. When the young man had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone Ezel, fell with his face to the ground, and bowed three times. Then he and Jonathan kissed each other and wept with each other, though David wept more. Jonathan then said to David, "Go in the assurance the two of us pledged in the name of the Lord when we said, 'The Lord will be a witness between you and me and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" Then David left, and Jonathan went into the city. That's back to Gibeah. We'll see where David left to in the next chapter or so. David came out from his hiding place at the stone Ezel, which means going. Jonathan had probably shot the arrows north of the stone Ezel. That's why it says David came out to the south side of the stone Ezel. He bowed down as he went to see Jonathan. He wanted to show respect to Jonathan as a prince, as well as to show his friendship. But in my opinion, that's pretty formal for a friend. And, you know, he was a prince too, so David's very formal. Then he kissed him, and then they wept. Then they got a little bit less formal. He got a little bit more emotional. And it says in verse 41, David wept more. He wept more than Jonathan. Why? Some people have speculated. Maybe it's because his situation was worse than Jonathan's. This is what David is about to lose. He's about to lose Jonathan's friendship. He's about to lose his wife, Michal. He's about to lose his relatives down in Bethlehem. If he went back to Bethlehem, a mere 4 or 5 miles south of Jerusalem, Saul could track him down, so he can't go there. He's about to leave his country. He's no longer a part in the government or life of Israel, despite the fact that he was a very popular military figure in the government. And he's not even going to have access to the altar of God, wherever that might be, Gilgal, Shiloh, Kiriath Yearim, wherever. He's going to be in the desert, in the woods, in the wilderness. So, yeah, he's in bad shape here. And, of course, it's an illustration of God's great providence that God made him king from such a lowly estate. David left, but he didn't have to. He could have raised an army. He was popular enough to do that. Saul was very unpopular. David was popular. He could have gotten the army on his side, and he could have started a civil war and taken the kingdom away from David. But he had never sought the kingdom. That wasn't his goal. He certainly wasn't going to risk all the bloodshed of a civil war. He decided instead to wait on the providence of God. And the providence of God worked so that he eventually ended up with the kingdom. He still had to fight for it, but it wasn't nearly. He was in a lot more advantageous position when he finally won the kingdom. As we'll see as we continue through 1 Samuel. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed 1 Samuel 20. And we are now ready to go to 1 Samuel 21. We will see David at Nob and Gath as he begins his life of exile in our next chapter, chapter 21. I hope you stay tuned for that chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this one.